Hi everyone, and welcome to another episode of Lid Publishing's podcast, Lid Radio. My name is Miro, and I will be your host for today's show. With me is the author of the upcoming Concise Advice book, The Brain Book, Phil Dobson. How are you today, Phil?
Very well, thanks, Miro. Good to be on the show. Thanks for having me on.
No, absolutely. It's my pleasure. And for our audience, Phil is a trainer, facilitator and coach and the founder of Brain Workshops. He works with organisations including the BBC, Jamie Oliver, Discovery and Viacom, providing brain-based training programmes that transform thinking and performance. Phil turns insights from neuroscience, cognitive and behavioural psychology, hypnotherapy and mindfulness into applicable skills and techniques for the workplace. That sounds very complicated, Phil, but very impressive.
Well, I hope it's... I don't know if it's either of them.
Well, I mean, personally, I'm looking forward to the Brain Book. I think it's going to be one of the really, really exciting additions to Concise Advice. And shall we just get started with the podcast?
Yeah, let's
go. Okay, great. I think my first question is kind of the most obvious one, but what inspired you to write the book?
Well, firstly, thank you for that kind introduction. I guess the inspiration for the book is an extension of what I've been doing anyway. I mean, the inspiration for the book is exactly the same inspiration that I drew on to set up Brain Workshops, and has been the driving force of everything I've really done ever since, which is this kind of basic premise, I suppose. Well, the belief that the more you understand about your brain and the more you apply that to anything, the easier things tend to become. So the list of organisations you rattled off a moment ago, the people I tend to work with, they're smart people, they're educated people, they're leaders, they are successful people in fairly high-ranking jobs, and yet they, like everyone else really, benefits from learning about how to use their brain better. So I knew there was a need. I've known there was a need ever since I became a hypnotherapist back in 2007. And back then, we certainly didn't know as much about the brain as we do now, but the general public, broadly speaking, are taught virtually nothing. We come out of our educational careers, I suppose, knowing very little about our body or our minds. And when we start working, we make up our own methods. We kind of learn on the fly. We might learn from other people, but broadly speaking, I think we don't use our brain as effectively as we could, and we suffer. As a hypnotherapist, people came to me suffering with sleep deprivation or the need to modify or change their behaviours. People would come to me because they lacked confidence, so they were very aware of one specific need. But the people I work with in organisations suffer no less. They just do it in a less tangible or observable way. So they feel overwhelmed, or they feel like their sleep suffers, or they feel stressed, or they feel their sense of balance is gone. So the book is the culmination of many years training with these people. And like you said, I combine neuroscience and cognitive behavioral psychology and stuff from NLP, neuro-linguistic programming. I teach people how to practice mindfulness and meditation. So it's a big, it's a really broad menu from which I draw. But over the years, I've become ever more aware of the specific things that people find most valuable, whether that's to do with improving their overall brain fitness and mental performance, or whether it's about helping them work smarter throughout the day. Maybe it's about talking about their creative brain and helping people become better problem solvers. I've become more and more aware that there's an approach, there are systems, there are simple steps, there are applicable techniques, etc., etc. And so I thought that I might be able to convey some of this in words that I don't speak and present, but instead I write down. So that was the kind of the broad inspiration on a personal level as well.
Mm-hmm.
I was genuinely attracted to the idea of having a 2 or 3 month project, which is what this book has become, something that has a very clear start and end, something that will give me the permission to kind of get out of town for a couple of weeks to get a cottage to set up an auto reply and immerse myself in something that was, and has been actually, a genuine pleasure to do. So yeah, it's been a ride, and we haven't even published it yet. So
right.
It'll continue to be this source of inspiration. It's been great.
Okay, and I know that you mentioned that, you know, people from all walks of life end up, you know, having difficulties when it comes to, you know, using, you know, their brains and not knowing a lot about their own bodies. But why do so many of us have problems with tapping into our brain power and our bodies in general? Is it lifestyles or perhaps work cultures?
That's a good question, and I don't know if there's a clear answer. I think the first thing to acknowledge is that most of us simply aren't taught. You could say, why is it that we struggle fixing the engines of our cars? And the fact is, it's not that we try and we fail. We just never try. We're never given the information. I mean, you can, it's there if you want it. And it's the same with our bodies and our minds. I did a degree in psychology, and yet still, after a supposed three-year, quite immersive study of the mind, came out with, honestly, very few applicable skills. I might have been better at stats. I might have been better at analysing information, kind of constructive thought. But I didn't have the tools that I learned as a therapist. So I think that's the first thing, to kind of forgive people, because it's not really their fault. It may be the fault of the current educational system. It may be, I don't know, I think there are lots of reasons why the information isn't presented. But now we have the information. Now there are developments in neuroscience, or there's developments in psychotherapies, there's development in projects and task management, getting stuff done, models. Then it becomes our responsibility. The stuff that I've learned and the stuff that I teach, I don't mean to belittle it, but broadly speaking, you can teach yourself this stuff if you read. So now it becomes up to us, and I think that there is this predisposition towards the passive versus the active. I think most of us have and maintain quite a passive relationship with the relationship between our bodies and our minds, our brains and our experience. And I don't mean to sound accusatory, but you can become a lot more active. And I think that the more you investigate, the more you embrace your curiosity, the more you try and find out ways to improve your performance, there's simple tricks often. It doesn't need to be, you don't need a particularly scientific mind to break down the principles. It doesn't need to be difficult. Some of these things you can apply with immediacy. I mean, things like mindfulness and meditation, of course, they are skills that develop with time, but challenging the way that you work, challenging the relationship you have with your email inbox. There are simple things that can happen. So I think that, yeah, we need to start taking more responsibility. I also think, actually, that there are misconceptions out there. Primarily, I feel, as having come from a background of hypnotherapy, I'm pretty experienced in the need, or the challenge of, people's misconceptions when it comes to things like hypnotherapy and meditation. So I think there is also, again, forgiving people for the fact that sometimes the information has been packaged in a way that is unhelpful, in a way that is esoteric, and therefore quite, it excludes them. So a lot of the times when I talk about hypnosis, people become concerned about relinquishing control. They feel, they get defensive that they are stronger than that, you know. And a lot of this, or a lot of the language I notice people use, comes from this misconception that hypnotherapy or hypnosis is done by someone to someone else. If you talk about using the mind and sort of untapping our potential, hypnosis is an amazingly powerful tool. But it's just presented to people in a way that either is something to do with stage hypnosis and entertainment, or it's something that demands a therapeutic approach, and therefore people feel, well, I need to have something quote-unquote wrong with me to embrace this learning state, which is really what it is. So, yeah, I think it's a mixture of things. Like I say, the more information we get, the more likely we are to engage in kind of more self-directed improvements. So I think that's definitely something, and hopefully the book can maybe be a step in that direction. I think we still need to take greater responsibility to invest in our own development, to challenge our own behaviours, our own assumptions all the time, whether that's at work, with your relationships, your family, whatever, your relationship with life. And I think that over time, as people get to experience things like meditations and mindfulness specifically more, which is definitely happening, the more there'll be a cultural acceptance, which will then promote or facilitate other people getting involved who may not have before, because they might have thought there was some strange narrative involved that they didn't buy into. So, yeah, I think there are lots of things, but hopefully it's we're moving in the right direction. People are ever more interested. There's ever more information available. And I think that everyone has an equal incentive or a motivation to get more out of their brain, or whatever you want to call it, to tap into our brain power. I mean, it's not just the organisation you work for that benefits if you can improve your productivity. You can have more time off. You can go on holiday more. You can get your goals quicker, whether they are professional or personal goals. So I just encourage people to learn about how you work, learn about your brain, learn about your mind, learn about your body, learn about subjective experience, and have fun with it. Because, yeah, there's a lot of fun that can be had outside of output, productivity, and kind of, I suppose, what a lot of people would call measurable effectiveness. It's so much bigger than that.
Right. And quickly going back, now I know that when you mentioned, therapy such as, hypnosis, there is a certain amount of, defensiveness and perhaps also stigma about the whole experience, like you say, judging from popular media and perhaps misrepresentation and misinformation. And I think that can translate into a work culture. And I think for the longest time, we never really talked about these things at the workplace and in our personal lives, of the fear of, being outcast, being an outsider, and, there's something wrong with us, as you say. But do you perhaps think that science itself, the neuroscience and all these other methods that you have applied, is enough to kind of show people that you should be embracing your brain and the power within you? Do we have the data to prove this?
That's a good question. So do we have the data to demonstrate kind of benefits by applying certain things? I think kind of yes and no. I think that the way science obviously is quite a broad term. Let's take neuroscience for one thing. More and more neuroscience is demonstrating how there can be short-term costs and long-term costs to certain types of behaviour. Let's say sleep deprivation, for example. So science, therefore, is giving us pretty valuable insights that if we want to sustain our performance in the short term and the long term, that something like sleep would be a pretty good thing to invest in. Equally, the development of fMRI scans and more developed brain scanning techniques, we can become ever more localized with our observations, which again gives us applicable insights. But I think your point is an interesting one. How can we demonstrate the return, the measurable return of applicable methods or techniques within the workplace? And there is a challenge here, and that's the fact that for many of us now, certainly most of the people I work with, I would suggest, our output is intangible. We are no longer building things with our hands to the same degree. We no longer have an output measured in units we have output in very kind of intellectual constructs. It could be leadership skills. It could be getting your team motivated, coaching skills, any number of things, and becomes less and less tangible. So can we measure the output? Well, I think we can. I think that save from measuring corporate output or organisational sales returns, etc., more and more we have the capacity, despite the fact that we use technology and a lot of our work is information-based, we have time-tracking software, we have wearable technology, all of which is sending us in a direction that if managed and if used responsibly and if used consciously, will, I think, give people and organisations, but I'll just work with the individuals for now, greater insights, greater data on their behaviours. So let me give you an example. I've been using for probably about a year now an online tool called Rescue Time. There's a free version, there's a premium version as well, but even the free version, as I use my computer over the course of the day, it will log or track the amount of time I spend emailing, the amount of time I spend on productive stuff. So that could be planning my time. It could be creating copy or content. It could be developing my website, whatever it might be, creating slides for workshops. But it also tracks, you know, if I go on Facebook, it tracks if I go on Twitter or Instagram or the equivalent. And I have the capacity to tell Rescue Time what I deem to be productive uses of my time and distracting uses of my time. So over time, at the end of each week, and as each week goes by, I get a better understanding of my data, my analytics, as it were. So I become ever more aware of my daily circadian oscillations, my biorhythms, the fact that I typically am less distracted in the morning. I am probably more, I have greater output on a Tuesday than a Monday. Now, some of this might be kind of obvious, but to have the data allows me to track, and anything that I measure, I can then start to manage, as the saying goes. So if then, through other wearable devices, I can start to compare, for example, my sleep cycles, the amount of sleep I got on Monday or Tuesday or Wednesday, and then my subsequent performance, it starts to give me greater power, because it gives me the insights to be able to create the conditions under which my subsequent performance tends to be greater than the other conditions, if that makes sense. So if I learn over time that I happen to perform best after 7.5 hours sleep, and my Tuesday mornings are my best day, and my Friday afternoons less so, it starts to give me the insights that enable me to go, all right, well, if I've got a meeting with someone, then it's probably better to do it on Friday afternoon than it is to sacrifice my Tuesday mornings. If I need to create something that I perceive as high value content, a strategy, a new workshop, something like that, then it'll be in my interest to plot that on a Tuesday morning. Now, a lot of these principles are the stuff I teach, but I think that technology, and specifically wearable tech, is going to start to give us, start to reflect our very own data back to us, because much like with neuroscience, as there is with biology and human biology and energy rhythms and everything else, there are principles, but there are also a great degree of individual differences. So the more you track your own data, the more, I think, insights you have that you can then use to become more effective, or whatever it might be. So, yeah, it's an interesting one. Now, there's the cultural piece as well, I think you mentioned, the organisational culture.
Yes.
And that's a tricky one, because I think that we, many of us, organisations, we do work in a fairly outdated setup. The environment probably is outdated. The 9-to-5 system, there's lots of research that demonstrates that that probably isn't the best setup to capture individuals when they are at their best or at their worst. I mean, everybody knows, or certainly the vast majority of people, 95% of people, will have a slump in their attention, their mental energy, their concentration after lunch. I mean, it's just a circadian slump that most people have.
And I need a nap straight out.
Huh?
Most of the time, I just need a nap after lunch.
Right, so there we go. So maybe take that as a better example. If everyone had a nap, you know, 25-minute nap at about 3:30 in the afternoon, their subsequent, measurable or otherwise, their subsequent performance would be elevated. And yet, what's stopping organisations start to create those initiatives? I mean, some do. The forward-thinking ones have relaxation rooms, and they facilitate greater autonomy with their people. So more and more you have organisations allowing people to work at home on Friday or whatever it might be, that sort of stuff. So people or organisations or leaders within organisations are starting to challenge this inherited 9-to-5, 9-to-6 work in a closed environment, in a particular building, in a box with, you know, three-dimensional walls and very little stuff on the walls. But we need to start challenging it. We need to start challenging the structure of organisations, the strategy of organisations, the KPI, the, you know, the key performance indicators, the fact that we are too short-termish, the fact that we reinforce this always-on culture, the fact that, on the one hand, a leader might facilitate, you know, working home on Fridays, but if that leader is the same person that emails their team at 9 p.m. on a Sunday, then there's an incongruence, the fact that you're facilitating one but you're taking away with the other. So there are lots of things that we need to kick up and challenge, and it all comes back to challenging your assumptions. Why is it you're doing it this way, and is it a behaviour that you have inherited? Is it a behaviour that you stumbled into, or is it instead something that you would genuinely recommend to other people? And if it is that, then you're onto something. And if you can't demonstrate the effectiveness, having tried other things, then it's worth challenging. It's worth mixing things up, I think. But yeah, it's small steps, small steps.
Okay, absolutely fascinating. And going forward, so is there perhaps any way that you can give us a few tips on how to boost our mental performance in kind of the everyday life? I know that we talked about a few things, but is there anything in particular that you feel has worked for you, for example?
Okay, so I think there are two ways to answer this. One is to upgrade your mental performance. Imagine, see it like a computer. One way is to upgrade your whole system, right, to get a more powerful machine. And then the other, if we're talking about measurable performance, it's using that machine better. So there's kind of the brain fitness side of it, I think, and then the brain function. So let's talk about the fitness side of things first. We've mentioned sleep, right? So if you are sleeping for less than 6 hours, you will have a drop in your performance, whether you are aware of it or not. The minute you do any empirical or statistical analysis on it, it's clear as day. So prioritize your sleep. Go for 7.5, maybe 8 hours. Manage your stress. I think that's important. Again, back to the culture of this always on piece. If you are overwhelmed, there's a massive drop in your performance. So take care of yourself. I think meditation, mindfulness are... I can't think of many more effective, more powerful gym equivalents for the brain. It's a conscious, deliberate use of your attention. And if your brain is the muscle that we now see it as, meditation and mindfulness and meditative practices can strengthen your attentional center. It means that your concentration improves, you become less distracted. And if you want to get better at that, I recommend Headspace. Is a great app, one I recommend highly. You can go onto my website, brainworkshops.co.uk, and there are links to SoundCloud clips of meditation recordings there. I think that physical exercise is often associated with physical fitness, but it's probably one of the best ways to improve your long-term brain fitness, but as well your cognitive performance each and every day. And it doesn't need to be a 90-minute session at the gym. You can just do a 20-minute walk and you will have noticeable improvements in your cognitive capacity immediately after that. But then I think there's also the nod to, you can have a brain pumping very well, but if you don't use it very well day to day, then again, the improvements in performance might be lost. So then I would recommend doing an 80-20 analysis, an analysis that enables you to find out what 20% of the things that you do generate 80% of the benefits or the return. For most people, for every 10 things that they do each day, two of them are the really valuable ones and the eight others are not that important. Find out what they are and focus more on the two and less on the eight or the 80. And then there's this whole piece about managing your energy throughout the day. We've already mentioned that most people are a bit ineffective at 3 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the afternoon. So therefore, make sure you get the most of your mornings. Attention is a big piece. If you, the more you can focus on one thing, the greater your output. It kind of, it's intuitive, but so often we find ourselves multitasking. We have multiple tabs open. We have our email inbox open the whole time and wonder why we find it hard to focus. We'll turn all that stuff off. Turn your email alerts off. Create the conditions or an environment which your brain finds it easy to focus on one thing for a sustained period of time. If you don't have that, then it doesn't matter how much exercise you're doing or how much you're meditating or how much sleep you've got. You'll be perpetually distracted. You'll be flicking from one task to the next. We don't multitask, we attention shift. And what we're doing with so much technology and this kind of this passive, like I said, use of it all, we're creating a culture or an experience of kind of continuous partial attention, this state where we never focus on one thing because we're trying to focus on everything. We're always on, we're never off, which means we're never really on either. So we just need to manage our minds, manage our energy and our attention more, become more conscious of when we're best and when we're not so good, and adapt accordingly.
Right. And I think, I mean, it absolutely makes sense to me. I think, as you say, you know, multitasking is not really multitasking. We're just shifting our, you know, our attention to something else.
Yeah.
And this actually leads me into my final question, and is the one that we ask all of the guests on a podcast, is what are you currently reading?
What am I reading? Well, there are a few things. I have just started an ebook that I got from Scientific American. I think it's called 9 to 5, Your Mind at Work. And it's really, by the looks of things, a collection of previously released or published articles all to do with some of the stuff we're talking about. The creative brain, innovation at work, the kind of culture of busyness. So that's been the most recent thing that I've begun. I'm also reading a book called The Neuroscience of Creativity. By, you might forgive me, it's Bristol and Kahneman, I think, or Kaufman, are the authors of that, an exploration into how, what neural correlates are there to aha moments, flashes of insights, the differences in the brain between divergent thinking and convergent thinking, etc. I also, my kind of daily or at least weekly feed of science articles comes from an app called Flipchart, Flipboard, is it? It used to be Zeit, but then they were bought. And that gives me a news feed of all the things that I'm most interested in for everything we've spoken about. So it's a feed of neuroscience papers and cognitive psychology papers, as well as productivity stuff, creativity stuff, resilience stuff, and all that malarkey. So that's the academic stuff. I've just finished John Steinbeck's Canary Row, which I enjoyed very much. And interestingly, talking about mindfulness, it's a very short book, but it's one that I found. This was last week. I was on holiday last week, and I read it then. It, for me, had as many observations about mindfulness as any of the books I read on mindfulness, in that it's all about observation. There is no investment in the long-term narrative. You're not really involved about wondering what's going to happen, and you could argue that very little does happen. Instead, it's about the present. I enjoyed it a lot. So, yeah, Steinbeck, Canary Row. And there is a whole library of books that are either half-scanned, half-read, or some of which are unopened, as is, will always be the case with what I do.
Right, okay, fascinating stuff. And with that, I would like to thank you so much, Phil, for taking the time to be on the podcast with us today. And as always, for our audience, all links will be in the description below, where you'll find all useful and relevant information about today's podcast. And if you would like to know more, you can always visit us at www.litpublishing.com and find us on all social media platforms at Lit Publishing. And if you would like to know more about Phil and the upcoming Brain book, feel free to visit www.brainworkshops.co.uk for all information. And thank you very much for listening.